Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Good morning, Lynn.
Morning.
We have a fascinating show for you this morning. Our first guest, Professor Dee Boersma. Professor Boersma's academic research is in the area of conservation biology and has focused on seabirds as indicators of environmental change. And since 1982, she's directed the Magellanic Penguin Project in Punta Tombo, Argentina. Her role is a scientific fellow for the Wildlife Conservatory Society. And over the last 23 years, she's carried out research on penguins in the South Atlantic and the first to show a direct impact of climate change on seabirds.
And our second guest this morning is Michael Waters. He's the director of the Center for the Study of First Americans from Texas A&M University. Waters is an archaeologist and geoarchaeologist. His work focuses on the first inhabitants of the Americas, specifically focusing on understanding when the first people arrived to the New World during the last ice age, where they came from, how they adapted to environments they encountered, and how they got here. His research is focused on the investigation of the Clovis culture and the evidence for occupation of the Americas before Clovis. This particular study is about the DNA of a baby boy who was buried in Montana 12,600 years ago and was discovered in the last month or so. It provides new indications of the ancient roots of today's American Indians and other native peoples of the Americas. That will be an interesting conversation. All that and today's cool story after this. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Elvin Bishop brings the blues, roots, rock and roll he's been known for over the last 40 years to the Egyptian Theater. After sold-out shows in 2013, he'll be back for three nights, Thursday through Saturday, March 6th to the 8th. A veteran guitarist who fused the blues with gospel, R&B, and country traditions, Bishop has collaborated with everyone from Jimi Hendrix to John Lee Hooker, the Allman Brothers to B.B. King. Tickets start at $39 and are available at parkcityshows.com or the box office at 328 Main Street. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts from Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital and part of the Intermountain Healthcare System. Park City Medical Center is proud to be consistently recognized as having some of the most engaged employees in the country. Little wonder, considering we offer all employees a pension plan, 401k, excellent insurance, and of course, year-round employment. We are currently recruiting nurses, registrars, housekeepers, kitchen staff, and more. Visit parkcitymedicalcenter.org to find your dream job.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open 7 days a week starting at noon for lunch, après-ski, dinner, drinks, and dancing. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
Good morning and welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest, Professor Dee Boersma, is tied up in traffic, but she'll be with us in, oh, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes. And, well, Lynn, you and I have some time. We can talk about today's cool story or stories. We can talk about them now, can't we?
Let's do that. There are some cool stories, especially in technology. It seems like every other day or so we're hearing about something new in technology. One of those things that you go, wow, I don't even think I knew that existed or the possibility of that existed. Like last week, talking about the purchase by Facebook of WhatsApp for $19 billion. That seems out of the realm of possibility. Also out of the realm of possibility is the existence of the Bitcoin, which is now failing, a second bank has now declared its failure.
Yes,
or a second system, I should say, because a Bitcoin, your understanding is, what is it? I mean,
It's a virtual currency that some folks got. Actually, the person that put this together is a big mystery. Nobody, I don't think, has ever met this person, and I don't know very much about it either. I just know that there was tremendous promise for it, and at the same time, there was tremendous controversy as people from the very beginning, we're talking about the criminal element that might be involved in this currency. And, of course, last week, Mt. Gox, the world's dominant Bitcoin exchange, blamed hacking for a tremendous loss, 850,000 Bitcoins valued at $500 million, U.S. dollars. And then last night, Canadian-based exchange Flexcoin has been forced to close down because 440,000, or excuse me, how many? Anyway, the value in U.S. dollars, $603,000. So they have closed down. And now Japanese regulators are jumping in to try to figure out what happened.
So wouldn't it be commonsensical to you, John, that the person who remains anonymous that set up this system would also be the hacker that hacked into it? I mean, it's the perfect crime.
Yeah, it is. And in the early days of security software, it was the engineers of the security software companies that were actually doing the hacking. And then they would hack at night, and during the day they would go and they would write code to, you know, provide protection. So, you know, it's kind of interesting.
It is interesting, and they have it over on really a large portion of the world's population who, you know, who aren't up to speed on technology. It's something that unless you're embedded in it and infused with technology every day, it's really hard to keep up with something that moves at such a pace.
Yeah, and I think even the most sophisticated user or the more sophisticated investor can possibly get scammed. I mean, a lot of things going on out there, Lynn.
That's right. Well,
yeah, I have a second story, which is fascinating, and that is it cost about, you know, it's expensive to put a satellite into space orbit. It cost about $25,000 per kilo, which is 2.2 pounds, and that's to put it into a geosynchronous orbit where communication and television satellites reside. Then flash back to 1979, Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote 2000 Space Odyssey and who wrote one of my favorite science fiction books, Childhood's End, he wrote a book called The Fountains of Paradise, where he proposed in his book that there be a space elevator that went from the Earth's surface to about a quarter to the distance to the moon.
Huh.
And that was, of course...
Is it a physical elevator or a virtual elevator? What kind of elevator? We're not thinking...
This one's physical. This one's physical. But anyway, so it cost $25,000 $25,000 per kilo to put a communication satellite in the air. And what they are proposing, and I'll tell you who's proposing it, is a brand new consortium. It is the International Space Elevator Consortium, who has taken Arthur C. Clarke's idea, and they are putting a little bit of detail and granularity to it. They're thinking that something can be built that would be able to get a payload into geosynchronous orbit for something like around $5,000 or $10,000 per kilo.
Fascinating. And, you know, it just gives rise to the conversation about how creative science can be and writers of science fiction. We talked to Daniel Suarez, the writer of the author of Influx last week about that very thing. It's, you know, these science fiction writers are coming up. It's their imagination. But really, that's what science is. It's imagination put into practice.
Exactly.
That's cool.
I can't wait for the hologram to be out there. You know what that is?
I know what a hologram is.
Oh, not the hologram, the holodeck.
Oh, no.
That's in Star Trek. That's when you get to fantasize about anything.
And there it is.
And the computer creates this environment for you. If you're on a, you know, gondola in Venice or who knows what, whatever your heart desires.
Mm, you're looking a little devious.
Yes, yes. I wanted to mention quickly that Arthur C. Clarke's idea was to have a space elevator that touched planet Earth and went into space. And this consortium's looking at something which starts about 99 miles up. And then you connect to what they call a climber tether. And then it tethers, this climber pulls the satellite the rest of the distance up.
Hmm. That's good stuff. I believe we have Dee Boersma on the line here.
Oh, great.
So let's...
Let me make a little introduction to her, and we'll get things cooking. So thanks, everyone, for allowing us to go out of order a little bit with today's cool stories. But anyway, let's see here. I'm gonna get a little more organized here. Our first guest, Professor Dee Boersma. Climate scientists say more extreme weather, including wetter storms and more prolonged periods of heat and cold, is one impact of a climate that's changing because of emissions and greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And while monitoring this Magellanic penguin colony, Dr. Boersma and her colleagues also documented regional temperature changes and increases in the number of days with heavy rains. The study, it's one of the first ones to show a direct impact of climate change on seabirds. Professor Boersma, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
Great.
Dr. Boersma, are you with us?
Yep, I certainly am.
Oh, great. We just hitting another button there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. How did you get started with this type of business, this type of research?
Well, it's not a good business. That's the problem. You should get into this if you're really interested in business. But I got I fell in love with penguins, really, and I really think that we need to share the globe with other creatures. And the more I learned about penguins, the more I found how fascinating they were, and they are incredibly amazing athletes. They can fly through the water and do 176 kilometers in a day. They can swim at the same speeds day and night. They can dive really deep. Emperor penguins, the biggest of the penguins, can go down about 585 meters. They can hold their breath for 23 minutes. Humans can hold their breath for about, 3.5 minutes. I can't, but people that train can, and then they can go about 295 meters deep without fins. But penguins can do better than even humans. And so I guess I was amazed by these physical feats, and I thought, we really need to have a place for them in the world. And at when I started this study on Magellanic penguins in 1982, the Japanese were thinking about harvesting penguins and turning them into high-fashion golf gloves and oil and protein. And I just found that rather egregious. And so I've been studying penguins ever since.
Great. And as I understand it, they are subject to hypothermia when their down gets wet and they lose its insulating air spaces. And that is the crux of the problem with increased rainfall?
Yes. The real problem for penguins is they live normally in desert environments. I mean, Antarctica is a desert environment. It's a cold desert environment. But now what's happening even in the Antarctic Peninsula is they're getting many more days of rain. And penguins are adapted to the cold, but when their down gets wet, it's just like you going on a camping trip and taking a down sleeping bag. And once your down sleeping bag gets wet, you're cold. And they're cold the same way, and temperatures are getting lower at night, and so they become hypothermic and die.
Dee, I'd like you to explain a little bit about the geography of the place you're talking about. I found it so interesting that we, myself included, believe that, all the penguins we see, the March of the Penguins, and you distinguish between where the emperor penguins are and the Magellanic penguins are found. And I was surprised to find them so far north on the eastern border or the eastern coast of Argentina. So talk about that a little bit.
Okay, well, I'll even surprise you more. Penguins are found on the equator.
Wow.
Now, we never think of penguins found on the equator, but I also study Galapagos penguins, and they're found only in the Galapagos Islands, and that's off the coast of Ecuador. And Ecuador, of course, is named for the equator, and the Galapagos are right on the equator. So there are penguins that breed on the equator and are found only on the equator. So penguins are really, we think of them as ice-associated because mostly we've seen the March of the Penguins, and those are the most incredible penguins, the emperor penguins, the biggest, and those crazy things lay their eggs in the middle of the Antarctic winter and raise their chicks, and that's an amazing film. But Magellanic penguins, the ones I work on, are halfway down the coast of Argentina. So they're at 44 degrees south latitude. So in the northern hemisphere, that's like Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
So it's a really temperate environment, and it's a desert right against the ocean, just like Humboldt penguins that breed in Peru are also on the desert. So there's a lot of penguins that are associated with deserts, and it's dry in deserts. And what we're seeing at Punta Tombo, which has got the largest colony of Magellanic penguins in the world, over 200,000 breeding pairs. So it's a real spectacle of nature. And it's those spectacles that I think are important. But now climate change is affecting them. So is there nothing we can do against climate change? No, there is. That's the thing that's so important. We can change many of these factors that are negative for penguins if we just do business a little differently. So, for example, if we had a marine protected area that covered about 100 kilometers, that would be large enough to protect the penguins when they're getting food for their little chicks.
What kind
of course, we don't have no fishing areas at Punta Tombo. We don't even have a marine protected area. So everybody can do whatever they want. And that really is a problem for penguins because the majority of penguins don't die from rain or heat. They die from starvation. So there are things that we can do. We just have to know the natural history, be able to understand it, and then change a little bit how people do business, and that'll make it better for penguins.
So when you're talking about changes of how people do business, you're not necessarily talking about climate change and our contribution to climate change.
Nope.
You're talking about protection. And what does protection involve? Is it little lean-tos so those little chicks can be protected from rain and all these heavy rains that are coming up?
No, what I'm talking about is let's just not let so many penguins starve. I mean, rains don't affect them every year. We actually recorded 233 storms during the last the 28 years that we did this study. And out of those 233 storms, only 16 storms killed penguins. So it's not like, you know, every storm or anything else, but the real problem is storms didn't used to kill penguins because they weren't as frequent, because the intensity of these storms and the frequency of the storms have increased. So we had chicks that died in like 13 of the 28 years. That's not every year. So storms don't affect them all the time, but that's the new change from climate change. We see that increased variability of storms and increased intensity. And those events, I mean, they kill people as well as penguins.
Yeah.
We've seen that with Katrina. Those are hard to predict. So what I'm arguing is, you know, there's other things that we can do, like having a marine protected area where there's no fishing, where the penguins can, you know, feed for their chicks. And that would make a big difference in their starvation rate. And that then ends up protecting these penguins. And what I want to see is this kind of spectacle of nature that people can see for generations in the future.
And interestingly, now your study has been going on for 23 years, and independent of that, halfway...
Actually, 28. We just finished 30 now.
Okay.
It's our 30th year.
Wow.
Fantastic. And while that's going on, independent of that, halfway around the world, the peregrine falcons are being studied in the Canadian Arctic by, I believe, Alistair Frank is the person's name, the University of Alberta scientist, who said that that they have a study that said that researchers reporting that heavy rains killed large numbers of hatchlings and documented an increase in the frequency of such rains over decades. And sort of the same type of thing. Is this going to be a concern for all seabirds?
Well, for many species, not only seabirds, there are lots of species that don't do well when they're adapted to a dry environment, and suddenly you get these storms that come through. So it doesn't matter whether it's little peregrine falcon chicks or whether it's little tern chicks or cormorant chicks or penguins. There's going to be a lot of wildlife that are affected by the increased intensity and frequency of these storms.
You know, it's interesting going back to the starvation component. Something that you brought to my attention was how much fish meal, I guess you would call it, ends up not feeding the penguins and not feeding humans as anchovies or herring or whatever it is. It's ending up in fish meal that feeds chickens.
Chickens and farm-raised salmon. So It's really how we use our oceans, and we've just really overexploited and caused the demise of many commercial fisheries because those fish are no longer available. We're doing that. We continue to do that. If you eat orange roughy from New Zealand, it's like eating your grandparents. I mean, those fish are 90 or more years old, and the same thing's true of Patagonian toothfish that we now name Chilean sea bass, but those are old fish. And that's like a mining operation. You take it out, and they're not going to recover. And so I think it's really important to think about, you know, how our actions are affecting the other species that inhabit the planet. And to me, one of the most amazing things is, A, we've done this for 30 years, and the only reason that's possible is because of the Wildlife Conservation Society and Friends of the Penguins, people that are interested in penguins that have supported our research. So this is, I want to make it clear that it's not supported by the University of Washington or the National Science Foundation. This is supported by, you know, people that care about penguins.
Mm. Now, speaking of people that care about penguins, you have been called the Jane Goodall of the penguin world. And I think Jane Goodall is, you know, she's such a household name, and we've seen her and her obvious love for what she does. And I picture you, I saw in an article, an interview with you, there were some photos of these little babies dying after, you know, being hypothermic after heavy rain. And talk a little bit about that, just your connection to these birds. And there's, you know, the adorable factor is, you know, it's pretty huge.
Well, you know, it's not only the adorable factor. I mean, of course, I mean, chicks are fuzzy and cute and all gray and covered in down. I mean, who wouldn't, you know, find those extremely attractive? But you have to realize that penguins live a long time. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of these Magellanic penguins that I started banding 30 years ago, some of the individuals that I banded 30 years ago are still alive.
Wow.
So, you know, you get to know these penguins, and they're not that different from people. They have a personality. Some of them are really aggressive. Some of them are pretty mellow. And so you get to know, you know, these birds and how they kind of behave in the world. And it's hard not to realize that they're just trying to make a living. They're trying to, you know, raise their young. They're doing the best they can. And they've got predators that try to eat them and sometimes are successful at eating them. And sometimes they go out and run into oil that has been dropped into the ocean, and then they get covered in petroleum. And that affects their insulating layer, and that kills them too. So there's a lot of things that humans are now doing to the environment, whether it's climate change or discarding of oil or plastic, that has an effect on penguins that, you know, 100 years ago, we didn't affect them that way. But 100 years ago, we just killed them directly.
Yeah, we're doing a pretty good job of that.
Went to the Antarctic.
If you have rainfall, you have predators, you have lack of food, if that wasn't enough, National Geographic just put an article out talking about Antarctica, and apparently there's 70 countries that have research bases in Antarctica, up to 5,000 people at a time, mostly scientists. And so it's one of the most beautiful, pristine environments on the Earth, but it's wrestling with a very serious pollution problem, and the very people who are working the hardest to protect the continent are basically responsible. I don't know if you saw that, Dr. Boersma, it just came out.
Well, I've read a lot about pollution in the Antarctic, but part of the problem, of course, is, again, even though there's not that much precipitation in the Antarctic, it concentrates heavy metals and things like that, and deposits everything from DDT to mercury in the snow or the rain or whatever is falling there. So our polar regions have much more concentrated heavy metals than our temperate regions. And so what we do in all of these countries in the world ends up affecting our poles. And, of course, climate change is happening most rapidly in these polar regions.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, the article's talking about McMurdo Sound and how because the water is so cold, a lot of these chemicals can't break down. So it's making the problem even worse. And it's as bad as, you know, Detroit in areas. So so
well,
that's
again,
a challenge,
I mean,
for
all
penguins.
These things, all these things go back to that we've got over 8 billion people in the world, and we're continuing to grow, and it looks like we're going to go beyond 9 billion, and we've got to change how we're doing business. And I think the most the most positive change is that most of us are living in cities. Over half the population of the world is now living in cities, and that's at least where we can concentrate our footprint, and that means that we can leave more of the globe for the other creatures that we share it with.
Professor Boersma, you have said before that you really, you know, you appreciate when penguins can be ambassadors, say in an aquarium, you know, in North America, where we can learn more about them and become connected to them and feel the importance of protecting a species. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the tourism. What I found when I was doing some research was that there's this road between Puerto Piramides and Punta Tombo, which is a very popular sort of tourist destination to be able to observe the penguins.
Well, Punta Piramides is one of the tourist destinations to look at southern right whales. And Punta Tombo is a tourist destination for people to look at this, the largest colony of Magellanic penguins in the world. And they're probably about 200 kilometers apart.
Okay.
But now they've got paved roads to both places, and nobody's talking about harvesting penguins anymore like they were in the 1980s, because we're getting over 100,000 tourists a year at Punta Tombo.
And I would... Go ahead.
No, they're coming to see the penguins.
Yeah, and I would imagine that being in a more temperate location versus, you know, I mean, I think about going to Antarctica, and even though I live in a mountain climate, it just sounds too cold for me and too inhospitable, really. But this temperate climate coming there, you know, it must be, you know, amassing more and more tourists, and that, I suppose, is a really good thing.
Well, there's good and bad sides of each one of these coins, but clearly Punta Tombo is one of the most accessible huge colonies of penguins in the world, because you can fly in an airplane into Trelew, and that's 120 kilometers from this colony, and go on a paved road and go out and see them. So that makes them so accessible. If you wanted to really go see the emperor penguins, it'll cost you a lot of money, because you're going to have, you can't fly in to the base where they filmed the March of the Penguins.
Mm-hmm.
De Montdeville, which is a French base, you have to go on a boat, and it would take you probably, 6 days to go on a boat down there. And so it's extremely expensive, as well as, you said, very cold when you get there.
Dr. Boersma, we want to thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks very much for having me, and let's hope that we can do more to balance the needs of wildlife with what people want to do, too.
That's
absolutely
right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. We're going to take a quick break for our underwriters, and when we return, we'll be talking with Michael Waters, director of the Center of the Study of First Americans. We'll be talking about the DNA remains of a baby boy who was buried in Montana 12,600 years ago. Well, you're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Jan, guess who?
What?
What do you mean, what?
Wait, what's going on?
When?
Or where?
Well, where do you think?
About what?
Huh?
Questioning your weekend plans?
Find out what to do, where to go, who to see.
And who's on first this fun Friday.
Clearly brought to you by
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
Homestead Resort,
Foothill Oriental Rugs,
Wasatch Pub, Squatters Pub and Brewery,
Summit County Business Directory.
Why, it's simple.
Tune in.
Tuna.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, we were just talking with Professor Dee Boersma about the direct impact of climate change on Magellanic penguins. Our next guest is Michael Waters. He's the director of the Center for the Study of First Americans at Texas A&M. Waters is an archaeologist and geoarchaeologist. His work focuses on the first inhabitants of the Americas. And this particular study is about the DNA of a baby boy who was buried in Montana 12,600 years ago. This study provides new indications of the ancient roots of today's American Indians and other Native peoples of the Americas. And Michael Waters, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, hi. Glad to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you. And when this baby boy skeleton was discovered, I guess it was about a month ago now, wasn't it? We found it to be quite fascinating. And I think the first question that comes up for the layperson is, what does it confirm that was formerly simply theorized by scientists?
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, these remains were found many, many years ago, decades ago. But the DNA evidence that we uncovered in this specimen, you know, clearly shows that, you know, with 100% certainty now, that the first Americans did come from Asia. And the second thing it shows is it shows the genetic makeup of these individuals in that they probably consisted of ancient or ancestral East Asians and kind of Western Eurasians that mixed together to create a unique population that eventually made their way to the Americas at the close of the last ice age. And then the other thing that it clearly shows, too, is that one of the most remarkable things was how related this individual was to, you know, Native peoples existing today in the Americas, especially those living in Mexico and all the way to the southern tip of South America, and just showing a direct lineage between the very first people in the Americas, you know, to the Native peoples that we see today. And, you know, that's always been thought to be the case, but now we have scientific proof of that.
So this is the Clovis culture, and you talk about maybe science first pinned down the geographic region to New Mexico. Is that right, of the Clovis culture?
Yeah, Clovis was first defined in New Mexico at a site known as Blackwater Draw, which is close to the little town of Clovis, New Mexico.
Okay.
Thus, it's got its name. But, you know, Clovis geographically occurs primarily in what is now geographically the United States and northern Mexico. Once you get farther to the south, you don't find Clovis, and you definitely don't find Clovis in much in Canada because it was covered with glacial ice at the time.
And what percentage of the DNA is identical with the people from Clovis today?
Pretty much almost a direct linkage. I mean, there's obviously been some genetic drift, but, I mean, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the nuclear DNA that's found in this Anzac individual and modern Native peoples. In other words, what we can say clearly is that whoever the parents of this baby, as well as their relatives, were actually the population that gave rise to Native peoples that we see today, especially to the south.
And these humans that made this tremendous journey from Asia, were they being chased by ice? Were they looking for food? What was their motivation?
Yeah, their motivation for crossing was you know, at that time, you have to realize that Asia was connected to Alaska. You know, when sea level fell, because there were large glaciers that covered pretty much all of Canada, that and that ice would have been over a mile in thickness, that where'd the water come from? It came from the ocean basin. So a land connection was created between Northeast Asia and Alaska. And this just would have been, you know, just like dry land. You know, you would have never known that this was a former continental shelf. And so there were animals on it, and people probably just drifted over as they were hunting and probably following the migration patterns of the animals and just kept moving, you know, from Asia into the Americas, not knowing that they were crossing from one continent to the next. And then eventually they either came by land or by sea, you know, past these, you know, large ice sheets and found their way into what is now the United States.
It's really interesting if you think about that in terms of miles. I mean, how many thousands of miles? And I realize it was a very gradual drift of these humans, but you know, it's fantastic to think that there would be, what, 10,000 miles, 8,000 miles?
Oh, yeah, easy, yeah. I mean, it's just a terrific, it's an amazing journey when you think about it, because you just think about the distances involved. Like you said, it's thousands and thousands of miles. And then the other thing you have to think about, too, is that these people were coming into a new continent. They were encountering different environments. Some of the animals would have been similar, probably, that they would encounter, like the mammoths and some of the other animals. But they probably encountered new animals, new plants. They had to learn the landscape, what was edible, what wasn't edible, what was poisonous, what wasn't poisonous, and then figure out and think about the disease corridor of Central America. How did they skirt that without coming into contact with all sorts of diseases? So these people were pretty tough.
So we're talking about the migration from Asia to the Americas, but throughout the entire world, I mean, the world's teeming with life, and many species, including humans, take great risk and have spread out throughout the entire globe, every continent, every mm-hmm. nook and cranny. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, it really truly is. And if you think about it, you know, the people in the Americas is really the last great. It's really the last continent to be occupied, you know, by anatomically modern humans. You know, modern humans, you know, evolved in Africa, left Africa, went to Europe, went to Asia, and then eventually the last continent to be colonized by modern humans was the Americas. And so it's actually the culmination of the story of our own species and how we colonize the world.
Do these peoples reach all the way to, you know, the tip of Patagonia as well?
Yeah, the ancestors of these people did, yes. Yeah, to back up, you know, Clovis, you know, doesn't represent the earliest people to come to the Americas. You know, Clovis, is, like I said, geographically is only found in basically what's today the United States and northern Mexico. You don't find it in Alaska, you don't find it in Siberia, and you don't find it in South America. So it's a culture or a technology that developed in the United States and probably the southeastern or mid-continent area. And it developed from people that were already here. And these people were here probably about 2,000 years before Clovis. And those were the first people that made their way to the southern tip of South America, being at Monteverde, for instance, in Chile, you know, by about 14,400 years ago, and other places in North America about the same time period. And then something happened around 13,000 years ago that their technology changed and this Clovis technology developed. And in South America, those people that got there early also then, you know, developed their local technologies to deal with their local environments.
Mm. I find it fascinating. I've been in the highland, in the Andes, you know, Peru and Ecuador, and those, the Indian population or the native population there looks so Asiatic, I guess is the word, the really high cheekbones and mm-hmm. Very fine features, small people. And they look like more direct descendants of mm-hmm. those you would find in Asia. Is that true?
Yeah, well, the first people that came into the Americas, like, and we have very little skeletal evidence. So Anzac being one of the earliest ones, and then there's several others that date maybe around 1,000 years after the Anzac specimen. And these people had distinct cranial morphologies. And in other words, their heads were a little bit more oval and less vaulted than, say, modern native peoples. And what happened over time was that these, you know, early skeletal morphologies are found, you know, across the Americas, and what happened through time is that skeletal morphology that you see today developed, and it developed to resemble people in Northeast Asia, as you say, because of the fact that their genetic heritage is from that area, and probably signals a dietary change.
We are speaking with Michael Waters, who's the director of the Center for the Study of First Americans, Texas A&M. And Michael, I would imagine you have a lot of questions that are unanswered in your line of work. If you were to have one of those questions answered, what would you like to learn?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. Yeah, there's so many questions I'd like to have answered. But, one of the intriguing things that was found with the study was that that the people that occupy Canada today are derived from the same hearth population that the Anzac child came from. But they have more of a relationship. Instead of being direct descendants, they're kind of cousins, if you might say. Mm-hmm. And so it'd be really nice to know what is the distribution of these, northern North Americans versus the southern, Americans, across the United States. And then see if we can then tie this together with the archaeological data. And so what I'd like to see, and the big question I'd like to see happen, is kind of a meshing of the genetic data and the archaeological data to tell a coherent story of the peopling of the Americas. And I think that's beginning to happen. And probably the biggest, unknown question is, what is the absolute basement date that people came into the Americas? It seems to be maybe around 15,000 years ago. And then to learn more about those people and how they developed into Clovis, because why would you change your technology at 13,000 years ago if your technology was working well for the, for the last 1,500, 2,000 years? So that's another big question. So actually, there's a whole series of questions all linked to, who were the first Americans and how they settled this great continent and how they dealt with the environments they were in.
You know, it's interesting. We talked to a lot of paleontologists on this show, and we'll hear of the, discovery of a new dinosaur that's in Utah, we have so many dinosaurs, and so it's a big deal. And so we'll talk to them. We'll say, oh, you discovered a new dinosaur. And they say, well, we actually discovered it like 4 years ago. And you said this about the skeleton of this baby boy. We heard it in the news just last month, but you say, oh, it was really discovered, when did you say? Oh. Like a decade ago?
Right. It was, the skeleton was first discovered in 1968. And it was discovered accidentally. But the thing is that in 1968, we didn't have the technologies to extract ancient DNA.
Right.
And that really only came online about 5 years ago or so. And so you've heard about, Neanderthal genomes and various other kinds of, genetic studies, in the news recently in the last 5-8 years. And so the work on Anzac was done at the University of Copenhagen by Eske Willerslev. He headed up the genetics team there. It really took about 5 years of working with the sample, developing new techniques for extracting ancient DNA because, you got to remember these bones have been in the ground for, almost 13,000 years. They've suffered degradation and leaching. And so there was only a small amount of the ancient DNA left in the bones of this child. And it took a lot of effort to figure out how to extract that out of the bones.
Yeah.
And so that's why this study took 5 years, and that's why we're just hearing about it now, is because we wanted to get it right. And so Eske and his team worked pretty hard on it.
That's right. Where was the skeleton actually discovered in Montana? Which part of the state?
It was kind of discovered in the central area of Montana, around Livingston, Montana.
Oh, right.
There was a rock overhang, and then right at the base of this little cliff, there was a small, talus pile, where debris had fallen off the side of the cliff, and, some soft sediment had accumulated, and it was in there that the human's remains were placed along with the 115 Clovis artifacts.
Okay. Yeah, I was just wondering if it had something to do with glaciers, receding glaciers and discovering, you know, skeletons that way, like the Iceman in the Dolomites.
Oh, yeah, no, not the Iceman.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the Iceman is unique because he was basically in the deep freeze.
Right.
And so what happened here is this child was buried in soft sediment and then covered and then slowly but time just, you know, the ravages of time decayed away, you know, most of the organic material and what was left with the bones.
I was surprised to find out that there are only 200 paleontologists in the world. How unique is a geo archaeologist?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I didn't even know there were 200 paleontologists, but I figured there'd be more than that. But geoarchaeology, what it is just the application of the concepts and methods of the geosciences to archaeological research questions. And actually, all my degrees are in the geosciences. I started out in archaeology and worked at a lot of archaeological sites, but then switched to geology because I was very interested in the question of the peopling of the Americas. And so much of understanding the peopling of the Americas hinges on understanding the geology of an archaeological site and understanding the age of that archaeological site. And so, to make a long story short, I'd have to say there's probably at least 200 of us that are practicing geoarchaeologists in the nation here, and there's more out there in the world because it's a subdiscipline of archaeology.
And you all get together periodically? Do you collaborate? Do you have a little club or anything?
Oh, yeah, kind of. You know, we have, there's a journal for geoarchaeology, and also, too, there's two organizations. There's the Geological Society of America has a division that's called the Archaeological Geology Division. And so there's something like several hundred members of that. And at the annual meeting, they try to get together for a social hour and to chat with one another. And then also at the Society for American Archaeology meetings, they have a similar organization called the Geoarchaeology Interest Group. And again, you know, faculty and students and other professionals get together and talk about geoarchaeology and what they're doing and, you know, interact with each other. So, yeah, we periodically do get together.
And you're a fun group?
Oh, of course, you know. And whenever you talk about dirt and archaeology, it's always fun. So, yes.
Michael, you sound like
fun. Definitely a fun group. Oh, yeah. Well, it's exciting research, you know.
And, oh, yeah.
How can you not have fun digging in the dirt?
Yeah.
In the dirt.
Yeah.
No kidding. You know, I have to ask you, Michael, since, I mean, we were talking about Montana, but I got on this South American. I think our previous guest was a researcher on the Magellanic penguins in Patagonia area. But I was thinking of this conversation I was having with my son the other day, who's taking world history, and he started to talk about the people of Easter Island and how there's really such a I don't know what you know about those people, and then, you know, their the archaeology there, the geoarchaeology, and what happened to those people and where did they come from and what's the mystery behind them, if you know about that.
Oh, that's a good question, too, but I say you're getting out of my realm of expertise there. So I can tell you about the first Americans, but the Easter Island is a little bit too far afield for me.
Yeah, I just wonder, you know, in terms of my migratory patterns and thinking about everyone coming across from Asia on this, you know, very far northern land bridge and down into the Americans, you know, those coming across in the South Pacific, you know, their migratory patterns were completely different and, you know, and maybe not on a land bridge, correct?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. And in fact, even people in the Americas, if you want to think about it for a minute, there's two routes into the Americas, and we still don't know which route the first people took. I mean, they could have either come by an inland route And in Canada, there were really two major glacial ice masses, one called the Laurentide Ice Sheet that covered most of central and eastern Canada, and then the Cordilleran Ice Sheet that covered up most of British Columbia and some of Alberta. And so where they met, there was a corridor there. You know, sometimes it was closed during the late glacial maximum. Other times, when the glaciers receded some, there was a corridor for people and animals to pass through, both going north and south. So it was a major corridor. And then, but also, too, the second route into the Americas is by boat, you know, just like people would have got to Easter Island by boat. And so it's entirely possible that the first inhabitants came to the Americas, you know, via a coastal route. Given the what we know about the closure of the ice-free corridor and the speed with which people got to the southern tip of South America and some other evidence, you know, they probably did come along the Pacific Coastal Rim. And there was been a lot of refugia along the coast where people could have stopped and hunted animals and gathered plants and shellfish and other things and eventually made their way to the southern tip of South America. Mm-hmm. And also, too, remember I mentioned that disease corridor?
Right.
That's a good way to, you know, skirt that Central American disease corridor as long as you stay along the coast. You know, you're staying away from the insects that can cause you harm. And there's one site in California just off the coast. It's known as Arlington Springs. And there, some of the remains of a human, their you know, upper leg bones or femurs were found, probably somebody who died accidentally on a fall, you know, were found there. And they dated around 13,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the Channel Islands were never connected to the mainland of California. So very clearly, whoever got out there to the Channel Islands was using a boat.
Right.
And so we know people were using boats of 13,000 years ago. So it's, you know, they more than likely probably came along the coast.
You know, it makes me feel like I need to get out of town more often. I feel pretty sedentary. Well, Michael Waters, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Our guest is the director of the Center for the Study of First Americans at Texas A&M. And Michael Waters, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, sure enough, and thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it and enjoyed it. So,
all right, take care.
Have a good day.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye now.
And that was Michael Waters. Want to thank both of our guests today, Michael Waters and Dee Boersma from the University of Washington via Patagonia. And let's go to a brief message from our underwriters. We'll be right back.
Get lost in time at the Kimball Art Center. The Art of the Timepiece exhibition is open, featuring more than 200 watches and clocks from a private collection ranging from the 1700s through present day. Experience educational activities for the whole family, or arrange for a free school tour of the exhibit running through April 6th. Details at KimballArtsCenter.org or at 649-8882. The Kimball Art Center is a nonprofit organization. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We want to thank everyone for joining us and tuning in this morning. Tomorrow on Fun Friday, it's Adult Swim with guest Terry Orr, who talks about the R-rated puppet show. And I'm not exactly sure what that means, but I think I'm going to tune in. And I also, Lynn and I, want to thank our sponsors, San Francisco Design, Prudential Real Estate, and Peak Art and Frame. Beth Fratkin, our producer. And that was a good show, Lynn. I enjoyed it.
I did, too. I love just talking about the penguins, and I learned so much about their distribution across the planet and, yeah, their struggles. I'd like to go to Patagonia. It's on my bucket list.
What I found most interesting was that these climate changes are affecting all seabirds or potentially all seabirds. Anyway, you are listening to KPCW Park City. We want to thank you again for joining us. Join us next week on Cool Science Radio.